From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we have a live concert with alto saxophonist Frank Morgan. After 3 decades in prison, he's back on the jazz scene, getting rave reviews for his records and concerts. Also today, we remember writer James Baldwin with an interview we recorded in 1986. Baldwin died Monday night at the age of 63. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles James Carr, a little-known 60s soul singer who drew critical comparisons to Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett. And book critic John Leonard reviews Chile, Death in the South, the new book by Argentine journalist Jacobo Timmerman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Fresh Air is proud to present a live concert from our studio with alto saxophonist Frank Morgan. Morgan has made a triumphant return to the jazz scene after 30 years in and out of California jails on drug-related charges. For years, his life revolved around supporting an expensive heroin habit, which he picked up as a teenager, emulating his mentor Charlie Parker. Morgan recorded his first album as a leader when he was 21 years old, and some critics hailed him as the next Charlie Parker. But shortly after this debut, Morgan was arrested, and for the next 3 decades, the only way to hear him play was to attend a concert in prison. When Morgan got out of prison in 1985, he was immediately given a recording contract. Many critics, fans, and fellow musicians who initially approached his music with curiosity came away astonished by the depth and emotional intensity of his playing. Morgan has a new album of duets with pianist George Cables on Contemporary Records. It's called Double Image. He's also just wrapping up an East Coast visit. He lives in San Francisco. In New York, he starred in a musical drama based on his life, and he also played an extended engagement at the Village Vanguard. In a New York Times review of Morgan at the Vanguard last May, Robert Palmer wrote, "Jazz doesn't come any better." Performing with Frank Morgan today are pianist Ronnie Matthews and bassist Walter Booker. I want to welcome all of you to Fresh Air. And Frank Morgan, can I ask you to introduce the first tune for us?
Yes, thank you very much, Terry. The first tune will be a Charlie Parker composition, very aptly titled, "Now's the Time." Thank you.
That sounded really terrific.
Oh, thank you.
And performing today is Frank Morgan on alto saxophone, Ronnie Matthews at the piano, Walter Booker bass. Would you do another song for us?
Oh, certainly. We'd like to play All the Things You Are. Or should we play Summer Night first of all?
Yeah, let's do Summer Night first.
Let's play Summer Night first, okay? This is a composition. I don't know who the composer is for sure, but I heard it on a Miles Davis recording, and it was sandwiched in between two larger tracks. Just so he played about 1.5 minutes of it. So here goes Summer Night. Thank you.
really beautiful. We're listening to a live concert from our studio with alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, pianist Ronnie Matthews, and bassist Walter Booker. Frank Morgan, I'd like to invite you to sit down at the table. What we'll do is we'll take a short break from this set, and I'd like the opportunity to speak to you for a few minutes about your music. Then we'll return to the second part of the concert. It's a pleasure to have you here. You really
It's a pleasure to be here. First of all, it's a pleasure to be alive and well. You know, I start from there.
Right.
Every morning when I wake up and I'm here and the world is still here and there's no one chasing me and I don't have to try to get together a lot of money to give somebody for something that I really don't need like I have for many years. That's a nice start for any day, whether it's cloudy or sunny.
It must have really taken a lot of strength to end that part of your life and to really end the addiction.
Well, of course, it's one day at a time. It's just now getting to be one day at a time. It has been like 20 minutes at a time.
You know, you just got back. Well, you're still going back to New York, but you're in the East Coast on a set of performances that's wrapping up now. And just a few days ago, you were performing in a show written by George Tro of the New Yorker magazine, based on your life. You were playing the role of yourself and performing on alto in it as well. The show is called Prison Made Tuxedos. What is that a reference to? Where does the title come from?
Well, the title comes from an actual thing that happened in San Quentin. I mean, on a weekly basis, many of us that were in prison there that played music were in a band known as the Warden's Band, simply because we played on a show that was the Warden's show that showcased many musicians and jugglers and dancers and even some artists that paint were on the show. Every Saturday night, either 1,500 to 2,000 people would come into San Quentin on the warden's invitation to tour the prison, see the gas chamber. Most people really wanted to see the gas chamber, I think. I think initially that was the case. Also, I think what developed was a lot of people decided that they would come back time after time to see whether Art Pepper was back or whether I was back or whether Frank Butler was back. So that the music was kind of on the musicians that, you know, kind of were on a rotating basis. So I think the people in the Bay Area got a chance to kind of say to themselves, wow, well, let's go over to San Quentin this night, you know, this Saturday night, because Art Pepper's back, you know, or Frank Morgan is back, or Frank Butler is back, or, you know, any number of people
treated it like a club.
Yeah, I'm saying Frank Butler and Art Pepper, because they've gone to the other side, you know, may they rest in peace and God bless them, you know, rather than name the names of any people that are still alive, you know.
Did you used to perform in that band in tuxedos that were made in prison?
Yes, I'm sorry. They were made in prison. They were dyed black from the original denim, blue denim material that we wore on a daily basis. They took them and dyed them black and got some bow ties. And the shoes that we wore were also black. You have to understand that San Quentin is a maximum security prison. So a tuxedo or anything that could be viewed as a suit was a very, very high security risk. And we could never keep them in our cells. It wasn't, you know. The shoes were taken away from inmates that had had someone in the shoe factory to make them some personal shoes. And they used to confiscate these from the inmates and then give them to us to wear on the warden show, take them back from us after the show was over.
Because
the boots that we wore in prison were brown, you know, and high tops. And these were, you know, custom-made shoes that were dyed black.
On your new album of duets, you play the theme from the movie Love Story. If you will, I'll actually request that you play this in the second half of our concert. But I was interested to read on the liner notes that this was something that you read in prison. It's a song you play beautifully, and I have to say it's a song that I'd really never taken very seriously myself, but you put so much heart into it. You play it so beautifully. You learned it in prison. What were the circumstances behind learning it? I was actually surprised to hear that.
I don't remember which one of the California institutions I was in when I saw the movie, Summer of 42. Very beautiful movie. And Love Story. No, I'm sorry. That's another song, which is a...
They're both from movies.
Yeah, both from movies. That's another song, The Summer Knows. Love Story, I saw the movie Love Story. in prison, and I wanted to play the song. And it was a beautiful song, but I didn't want to play it in prison. Because at the time I saw the movie, there wasn't the kind of sensitive musicians in prison to play it with, number one. But it's kind of the thing that I wouldn't want to play unless I was free. So now when I play Love Story, it's my freedom. It's also a song that that I play to my grandmother, who was buried in Milwaukee, that was asking for me on her deathbed when I was in San Quentin, and needless to say, they didn't allow me to go. And so when I had the chance last year, I went to Milwaukee for a family reunion, and I went to my grandmother's grave, and I played Love Story.
Really?
For her. And so every time I play it, it's for her.
It's obviously a very emotional performance.
Indeed,
for you.
Indeed. Yeah.
How do you think your playing has changed since you got out in 1985?
Well, I hope that I'm growing. I'm trying to be the best saxophone player that I possibly can. I'm trying to find time, and I'm finding time to practice. I'm going to find more time to practice. I think that as I grow as a human being, my playing will also grow. But that's very important.
When you practice now, what are you working on? What are you trying to improve or change in your playing?
I'm trying to get in touch with myself. I'm trying to find the deepest spot within inside of me to release whatever's in there. It hasn't been released, you know, because I don't know it. I'm just finding it. And of course, the quest will go on forever, but I think on a daily basis, it helps me to grow and to be optimistic. You know, I need to practice, and I need to play, and I need to learn how to play what I really mean, not just what I know, but to play what I really mean from that deepest part of me.
I think a lot of your fans are really curious and interested to find out what your experiences were like during the years that you were in jail, but I wonder if that's something you're really trying to put behind you now, if it's something that you're uncomfortable talking about, or you know, a chapter of your life that you'd like to leave closed. I don't really know how you feel about it.
It's not that I'm so uncomfortable talking about it. I think that that my past, if we spend too much time talking about that, then we don't leave enough time to view the here and now. And what was, what is.
You're involved in a lot of very exciting things now. I mentioned before you just...
Life.
Well, yeah, and also in terms of performing, some terrific performances.
But it's all life. You know, I'm alive. You know, I mean, I'm not walking around, you know, looking to be deader. I'm trying to find my sensitivities. I'm trying to get in touch with everyone's sensitivities. I'm trying to put some people in touch with their sensitivities since God gave me the gift of communication in this form.
One more thing I want to ask you before we return to the second part of the concert. You're, I believe, in the process of relocating from San Francisco to New York.
Yes. In fact, I would say that I've already moved.
Mentally.
It's just the physical side of it now. I love New York. I love San Francisco, too. But San Francisco is San Francisco, and New York is New York.
New York is more of the capital of the jazz scene.
Has always been.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And, you know, I think that I need to be here. I need to be in New York.
Well, I'd love to hear you perform some more. So I want to thank you for giving us this... short interview, and let me tell everybody that we're about to return to a live concert with alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, accompanied by pianist Ronnie Matthews and bassist Walter Brooker. But before we go back to the concert, we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Back for more of our live concert featuring alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, pianist Ronnie Matthews, and bassist Walter Booker. Can I ask you to play this song that you mentioned before, Love Story?
Oh, I'd love to play it.
Really beautiful, and I'm sure our listeners have never heard that played that way before. Let's see. I'm just checking the clock. We have a little less than 2 minutes. Can I ask you to play one last tune for us?
Thank you.
want to thank you all for a wonderful performance this afternoon. And my guests have been alto saxophonist Frank Morgan, pianist
Ronnie Matthews,
and bassist Walter Booker. Thank you all so much for the performance. And if you want to hear more of Frank Morgan's playing, let me recommend his new album, just released on Contemporary Records, called Double Image. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with New York Times architecture critic Paul Goldberger, so I hope you can join us. Can I ask you to play blues just to take us to the end of the program? This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember writer James Baldwin. The author of Go Tell It on the Mountain and The Fire Next Time died Monday night at his home in France. We'll feature an interview we recorded 1 year ago. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines the career of James Carr, a soul singer who was compared to Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett, but is little remembered today. And book critic John Leonard reviews Chile, Death in the South, Jacobo Timmerman's analysis of the dictatorship and its opposition. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. The Justice Department says a number of issues have been worked out in the standoff at the federal prison in Atlanta, where Cuban inmates are holding 90 hostages. Federal authorities today asked Roman Catholic Bishop Augustine Roman to be ready to assist in negotiating an end to the 9-day-old siege. The Miami bishop helped work out a deal over the weekend that led to the surrender of Cuban inmates at a federal holding center in Louisiana. But Justice Department spokesman Pat Corton said an agreement cannot be negotiated until the inmates unite under a single leadership.
Here in Atlanta, the detainees remain divided, with a recalcitrant minority blocking any efforts at achieving an agreement. The bishop's involvement here can come only after it is clear that the detainees are speaking with one voice through the negotiators who represent all of those inside.
Corton says there are signs of progress. He said it appears from today's talks that a small group of militant inmates may be losing its influence in the negotiations. The Supreme Court today refused to let New Jersey public schools allow a moment of silence. The justices voted unanimously to dismiss an appeal to reinstate the law after a U.S. Court of Appeals struck it down as a violation of the constitutional separation of church and state. But the High Court remained silent on the validity of laws in other states that provide a moment of silence in public schools without mentioning the word prayer. The Indian government today filed criminal charges against the Union Carbide Corporation for the 1984 Bhopal gas leak. Mark Tully reports.
It's taken the Central Bureau of Investigation almost exactly 3 years to file these charges against the 9 top Union Carbide officials. They include the former chairman of the corporation, Warren Anderson, and the chairman and managing directors of the Indian subsidiary. They are accused of being aware that the design of the Union Carbide plant was faulty and that the plant was not properly maintained. The police, for instance, claim that the tanks containing the poisonous gas which killed nearly 3,000 people were not kept at the correct temperature or pressure. The Union Carbide officials are charged with culpable homicide, which is in certain cases the equivalent of murder under Indian law. The death penalty has not been abolished here.
The BBC's Mark Tully in Delhi, a spokesman for Union Carbide, calls the charges completely unfounded. The World Health Organization today issued a policy statement on AIDS and human rights. The organization says policies which do not discriminate against infected people have the best chance of controlling the spread of AIDS. Burton Bolog has details.
Around the world, countries are trying to stop the spread of the deadly disease. The World Health Organization says education for the public and counseling and support for infected people is the most effective way. The organization's AIDS expert, Dr. Jonathan Mann, says trying to isolate AIDS carriers is counterproductive. The best approach is
for society to avoid discrimination which will threaten public health and threaten it by driving people who are infected or concerned they might be infected underground so that discrimination itself becomes a danger to the public health.
Although some countries, including the United States, now require an AIDS test for would-be immigrants and some others, the World Health Organization says there has been widespread acceptance of the non-discriminatory approach that it's advocating. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Geneva.
Famed black author James Baldwin is dead of stomach cancer. For more than 30 years, Baldwin produced an array of sometimes angry novels and essays that depicted the impact of racism in American society. James Baldwin died last night at his home in southern France. He received critical acclaim for his books, which included Giovanni's Room and Nobody Knows My Name. Citing the bitterness of racial inequities in America, Baldwin lived for the last 20 years in France, where he died at age 63. I'm Sharon Green, reporting for National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a profile of James Carr. Carr was a soul singer in the 60s, who Ed says had the goods but didn't always deliver. He was in top form on this recording of These Ain't Raindrops.
Just look at me now. I've been crying because I love you. I wonder why can't you see now? Just one kiss would do so much. It would drive away all my fear. These ain't raindrops in my eyes. They are tears.
Is it possible to have too much soul? Is it possible that some of the most soulful artists are driven by a sense of doom or that they're haunted in some way? Of course, it's impossible to give an answer to questions like that, but the evidence sure makes it look that way. Take the case of James Carr, for instance. There are some who consider James Carr the greatest soul singer of the 60s, a man on a par with Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, or Percy Sledge. Yet today, few remember him. James Carr's story starts with Roosevelt Jameson, a remarkable young man who was the first black man in Tennessee to become a certified radiologist. By day, Jameson helped to run a blood bank on Beale Street in Memphis, and it was there that he met James Carr, who was part of a gospel group Jameson rehearsed at the blood bank. Jameson was looking for someone to help him realize his musical ambitions. Because he was a tremendous songwriter, he'd written That's How Strong My Love Is, which Otis Redding and the Rolling Stones recorded, but he was a lousy singer. He took Carr to Goldwax, a tiny Memphis label just getting started, and with their third record, they hit pay dirt.
I said I wasn't gonna tell nobody else, but I just can't keep it low to myself now. For as long as I've been running around, I finally met a little girl that really got me down now. Baby, you got my mind messed up now. Little girl, you sure got my mind messed up now. I go to bed, Lord, and I can't sleep. Sit down at the table, ooh, Lord, I can't eat that. Somebody please, please help me now. Oh, 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 oh. Sugar plum dancing all in my mind. Every day you whip me seem like Valentine.
You've Got My Mind Messed Up was a top 10 soul hit in the spring of 1966, and Carr was on his way.
You push me when I'm falling, and you kick me when I'm down. cause I should have been a clown.
Pouring water on a drowning man showed Carr really hitting his stride, getting out from the shadow of the other Memphis singers, and it looked like Jameson had hitched himself to a star. Then he was handed a song by songwriters Dan Penn and Chips Moman, a song Carr could do to perfection, and he knew that this was it.
At the dark end of the street, that's where we always meet, hiding in shadows where we don't belong, living in darkness to hide our wrong. You and me at the dark end of the street. You. I know time's gonna take its toll. We have to pay for the love we stole. It's a sin and we know it's wrong. Oh, but our love keeps coming on strong. Still wait to the dark end.
Unfortunately, that was just about it. Carr was acting weird, drifting off into his own universe in the middle of sessions, disappearing for days at a time. Goldwax, too, was falling apart. And although they managed to get Dark End of the Street into the top 10 soul records, it was the last time they'd have that kind of clout. But hardcore soul fans remembered him, and Roosevelt Jameson's faith in him remains to this day. Japanese fans organized a concert in 1979, and Carr and Jameson went over, but Carr spaced out and got lost early in the show, which ended in disaster. James Carr may never come back from the dark end of his street, but thanks to the recent reissue of his best recordings by Blueside Records and Peter Guralnick's spellbinding account of his story in his superb book, Sweet Soul Music, he's not going to disappear.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
It's coming. Can't you hear that whistle blowing? It's time to get your ticket, y'all, and get on board. It's time for all the people to take this freedom ride. Got to get together and work for freedom side by side. That's why I tell y'all.
You're listening to Fresh Air. We'd like to take this time to remember writer James Baldwin. He died Monday night at his home in southern France. Baldwin was 63 and had been battling stomach cancer. Baldwin was one of the most influential writers to emerge during the Civil Rights era. His essays and novels addressed race issues head-on. Baldwin's best-known works include Go Tell It on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room, Nobody Knows My Name, The Fire Next Time, and Another Country. For most of his adult life, Baldwin lived as an expatriate in France. I spoke with James Baldwin last year on a visit to Philadelphia. He told me that he grew up in Harlem, where his father was a preacher in a storefront church.
Daddy was old-fashioned, fire and brimstone, hellfire preacher. You know, very direct, very chilling sometimes.
Was it pretty frightening to have him as a father, and I'm thinking if he thought that he was directly connected to God,
then he didn't really give him a lot of power.
Well, yes, he did have the aura of the divine about him. That is to say, his orders were not only coming from him, but from the Almighty. So in a way to contest him was to be contesting, you know, the Lord, to be fighting the Lord. Of course, my father was not slow to, you know, to point this out. there was something very frightening about it.
You became a preacher when you were 14.
That's right.
Why did you do that?
Well, it was almost inevitable, you know, being raised that way, and after all, not doubting anything my father said, not doubting the gospel, not doubting the church, you know. And at the time of puberty, when everybody goes through a storm, you know, the storm of self-discovery, the storm of self-contempt, the storm of the terror of who is this self, which is suddenly evolving, you know, suddenly is distinguishing itself from other selves. And all of these things, and the sexual question, of course, you know, all of these things sort of coalesce into some kind of hurricane, in a way, you know. And in that hurricane, what did I do? I reached out for the only thing I could, which I knew to cling to, and that was the Holy Ghost.
So by being a preacher, you didn't have to, you were able to, like, put on the back shelf for a while, sexuality and mm-hmm. entering adulthood and those kinds of things.
Well, it didn't work, actually, you know. I mean, I was in the pulpit for 3 years. And all of the elements which had driven me into the pulpit, you know, were still there, were still active, were still, I was not less menaced. And in those 3 years in the pulpit, it's very difficult to describe them. I probably shouldn't try. There was a kind of torment in it, but I learned an awful lot. And my faith, perhaps, I lost my faith, or the faith I'd had. But I learned something else. I learned something about myself, I think, and I learned something through dealing with those congregations. After all, I was a boy preacher, and the congregations I addressed were grown-ups. And a boy preacher is a very special aura in a black community. And that aura implies a certain responsibility, you know, and the responsibility above all to tell the truth. So as I began to be more and more tormented by my crumbling faith, it began to be clearer and clearer to me that I had no right to stay in the pulpit. And I didn't know enough. I didn't, the suffering of those people, which was real, was still beyond the ken of a boy, 14, 15, 16. You could respond to it, but I had not yet entered that inferno. They knew something about being a nigger, which I was only just beginning to discover, and it frightened me. So, for those reasons and complex of reasons, I left. I left home and left the church.
What did you do to try to get your foot in the door somewhere as a writer?
Well, I wrote all the time, you know. I worked all day and I wrote all night. And I learned a lot. I began to be being published when I was 22. I had a fellowship when I was 21. And something else was happening too, though I didn't quite see it. I was defined as a young Negro writer. And that meant that certain things were expected of a young Negro writer. And what was expected, I knew I was not about to deliver. But what was expected was to, I'm putting it very brutally, but what was expected was to accept the role of victim and to write from that point of view. And from my point of view, it seemed to me that to take such a stance would simply be to corroborate all of the principles which had you enslaved in the first place.
Go Tell It on the Mountain was a fairly autobiographical novel, and it really won you a lot of attention and prestige in America. Your book of essays, The Fire Next Time, which was published in 1963, was, I think, perceived by many whites as an attack against whites, like he's threatening us with the fire next time. Did Did that happen? Did some white people see it that way, and did it change your reputation to becoming more of a controversial writer?
Yeah, but that had happened. That had begun to happen already without my quite noticing it. Because long before the Violinist's time, which was not during this attack on white people, they flatter themselves. long before that, when I first went south and tried to begin to, because I went as a reporter, and I tried to get the story published, you know. The first few magazines when I came back, did not want to publish the reports because they accused me of fomenting violence. Now, I was describing violence, which is not a violence which I was in no way responsible, and I thought that people should know what is going on and why it's going on. And in the battle, you know, to do this, I became notorious. In any case, the battle I was fighting, it seemed to me, was not simply about black people, but also my position as concerns white America was, it's your country, too. It's your responsibility, too, you know. And the Finex time is probably the culmination of all those years, you know. It was when I was being called the angry young man on the white side of town and being called Uncle Tom on the black side of town.
You've been very outspoken about civil rights issues and about black issues in America, but you've been much less outspoken about homosexual issues.
Well, go ahead.
And I'm just thinking that in a way, homosexuals have been marginalized in both the white and black parts of American culture.
Well, there's no point in mixing the two questions, because it only leads to terrible confusion. And in America, in any case, the homosexual question is tied up with the whole American idea of masculinity, the whole infantile idea, according to me, and absolutely untrue. To be a man is much more various than the American myth has it. It seems to me, the life I myself have lived, the life that I have observed, that love is where you find it, you know. And your maturity, I think, is signaled by the depth or the extent to which you can accept the dangers and the power and the beauty of love.
Some of your writing has really been, I think, very important to gay people and people in the gay movement in America. And I wonder if the gay liberation movement had any effect on you, if it was important for you to have, you know, a movement about that.
No. I left the church when I was 17 and have not joined anything since. You see, before I left this country, I have been afflicted with so many labels that I become invisible to myself. No, I had to go away someplace and get rid of all these labels to find out not what I was, but who. Do you see what I mean? And the gay liberation movement is ideally an attempt precisely to find out not what one is, but who one is. And also to have no need to defend oneself, you know. So it was a very simple matter for me, in any case, to say to myself, I'm going this way, you know, and only death will stop me, you know, and I'm going to live my life, the only life I have, in the sight of God.
Writer James Baldwin, in an interview recorded in 1986, Baldwin died Monday night at the age of 63. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up today?
Well, we're following the Atlanta federal prison story and the negotiations there to try to end the hostage situation. Also, a tour of what a space station might be like and a debate in Washington, D.C. about a national march. Do we need one? And should it be a rather famous Sousa march?
I know you'll mark the passing of writer James Baldwin.
We will. We have a tribute from Verda Mae Grosvenor. And also, we talked to novelist John Edgar Wideman about his appraisal of James Baldwin, the novelist.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of a new book by Jacobo Timmerman. Timmerman is a leading Argentinian writer and journalist and an advocate for human rights. In 1977, Timmerman was arrested for his opposition to the reigning military junta. 2 years later, he was released, expelled from his country, and had his citizenship revoked. Timmerman lived in Tel Aviv, Madrid, and the United States before returning to Buenos Aires in 1984. Recently, Timmerman has spent time traveling through Chile. His new book is based on his observations and on his interviews with political voices there. It's titled Chile, Death in the South.
Think of Timmerman as a 20th century ancient mariner. He keeps hitting us over the head, but in each book it's with a different albatross. In Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number, the Argentine journalist told of his arrest and torture for having insisted on publishing in his newspaper the names of the disappeared. What many of his readers really didn't want to hear about was the neo-Nazi anti-Semitism of his torturers, nor the acquiescence in that torture by Argentina's silent Jewish community. In The Longest War, written in exile in Tel Aviv, he disdained the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, to which he had given his son. What his readers, especially in Israel, didn't want to hear at all was a criticism of Israeli morality by someone who, however Jewish, had no personal experience of the Holocaust. Timmerman had been tortured in the wrong language, in Spanish instead of German. And now he brings us the bad news from Chile. Of course he tells horror stories of the Pinochet dictatorship, but he also has doubts about Pinochet's political opposition, and his contempt for left-wing terrorism is absolute. The man's a brilliant scold. He hadn't been back to Chile since the murder of his friend Allende. He finds demoralization and incoherence. He quotes from the terrible testimony of men and women brutalized, on rape as an instrument of state policy, on murder as the norm. He scorns the Nixons and Kissingers who conspired to ruin the oldest democracy in the Americas. He considers the numbed psychology of the afflicted and the powerful and destructive grip of nostalgia on the imagination of Chile's liberal parties and the impotent romanticism of the exiles who go helplessly home again. He says a number of original and outrageous things about writers as various as Kafka, Neruda, García Márquez, and Vargas Llosa. He evokes to chastise and describes to weep. But Pinochet is not about to be dislodged, he says, by the phantom armies of the left, pseudo-guerrillas who've convinced themselves that they can overwhelm the military, when all their violence does is grease the wheels of the killing machine. Left-wing extremists, and I quote, tried to make themselves appear more dangerous than they were. It was a tale told by an idiot, but it was sufficient to motivate the armed forces, and it drove them to commit the first acts of genocide in this century in the three most civilized societies of Latin America, Uruguay, Chile, and Argentina. Timmerman's on firm moral ground. You can't hate torture while at the same time winking at terrorism. His political ground is trickier, but it makes common sense, too. Chilean democracy, he says, will be a practical process, not a ferocious tantrum. It will involve liberals, a new pragmatic right, disenchanted army types already repositioning themselves, an activist church, and, most remarkably, the help of the United States after we sober up from our binge of Reagan adventurism. There will be nothing romantic about it. The Americas have already had more than enough of bloody poems.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Chile, Death in the South by Jacobo Timmerman. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with drummer and composer Bobby Previtt. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new compact disc featuring the Swedish tenor Jussi Björling. And Jan-Harald Brunvand will explore the urban legend of the solid cement car. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.